So we are holding on Sadiq Ahmed Bey's last line, the second line of the wide line, the three lines from the bottom. We started talking about yesterday the various things that you have to be careful about in order not to cause prices to rise. The last thing we were talking about was the whole business of hoarding protein, which then causes prices to rise, which makes things difficult for everybody. We said you're allowed to hoard for 3 years before and during Shemitah because you're going to need to sell it. You're going to need to sell it during Shemitah. People have to have what to live off during Shemitah. And the last thing we said was that we said Rabbi Yosef Chanina also in fact did that, which I didn't have a chance to mention yesterday. But the point of mentioning it is that Rashbam says he lived long after the Churban. You might argue in his time Rabbi Yosef Chanina. You might argue in his time Shemitah doesn't apply anymore. Nevertheless, he held that it does, and therefore the din was still relevant.
Yeah. How long was that? 3 years?
3 years. No. He lived a lot longer than 3 years. He lived after the Churban. How long after? I don't know. A couple of generations. Anyway. Okay.
Do you know hoarding?
Yeah. Hoarding, like storing up produce so that, you know, which then later on when there's less of it, you'll sell it at a higher price. Okay. Three lines from the bottom. You are not allowed to export produce from Eretz Yisrael, the kind of thing that people need for basic life. For example, wine or oil or flour. Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseda says it is allowed with wine. Because that way you're reducing the amount of frivolousness that there is. Wine has all kinds of negative consequences. People drink too much of it. So like this, you export it to Eretz Yisrael, good. There'll be less of it in Eretz Yisrael. There'll be less of it to cause problems.
So what's the opinion of canning?
So the halacha is not like him. The halacha is not like him. I think the halacha is that you that the same rule applies to wine as to anything else. That you can't export them.
You cannot.
You cannot. That's what we're saying. You cannot export these things from
Israel all the time.
So nowadays, this is talking about when there might be a problem, when there might not be enough in Israel to support the local population. Nowadays that's not an issue. Then the pashtus you would be allowed to. Just as you're not allowed to export from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz La'aretz, as we were just saying, the same thing also, you're not allowed to export from Eretz Yisrael proper to Syria, which we know throughout Shas. Syria is the area that David HaMelech conquered before he had completed conquering all of Eretz Yisrael. It has in certain ways. Syria isn't necessarily the same as with modern-day Syria. It's substantial parts of it. Substantial parts of Lebanon, Syria, and whatever. But they have a status in halacha kind of halfway in between Eretz Yisrael and Chutzlar. Certain dinim that apply, certain mitzvahs at Luris Barak do also apply in Syria, at least Midrash Rabbanan. Certain ones not. So this sort of thing also applies that you can't export from Eretz Yisrael to Syria because it's still not considered to Syria because it's still not considered Eretz Yisrael. The Rebbe Matim Hifrachia Lehifrachia. Rebbe allows it if you're exporting from one county, let's say, in Eretz Yisrael, to a neighboring county in Syria. So like last Ephrachim, like a county or a small area that's not a district, yeah, whatever. So from the furthest north district of Eretz Yisrael to the furthest south one of Syria, let's say, or east and west or whatever, you're allowed to because they're right next to each other. There is a different gerusa which the Rif has, which is that the Tanakhama is saying even from Hifrachia to Hifrachia is Osir, and it's even within Eretz Yisrael. And Rebbe is allowing it from Hifrachia to Hifrachia. That is how the Rif passed in the corners of the Chachamim, so does the Rambam, and therefore the halacha becomes that even within Eretz Yisrael itself, you're not allowed to do from one Hifrachia to the other, from one district to the other.
Just because
you don't want that there should be a shortage in one area, and there's going to be a shortage in one area. One Ephrachia to the other is going to, there's going to be problems.
Nowadays it's not
as much of an issue necessarily. Okay. Turn it up on them. You're not allowed to make a profit in Eretz Yisrael things that are needed for basic living. So again, Venganus, Shimonim, Aslosis, again, like wine and oil and flour. So yesterday we talked about the idea of not profiting by more than 20% on these things, exclusive of, you know, like Tosfos says over here, what we mentioned yesterday, that you consider your cost of labor and whatever, and then you add 20% of that to that's the maximum. In Eretz Yisrael, you don't even have that. In Eretz Yisrael, there should be middlemen over there that you buy from a balabas and then sell it at a profit in the market. The balabas himself should sell it to people who need it. So it's different that Rashbam says, let's say if you have wheat, you make it into bread, that's fine. You're allowed to make a profit on that. You put effort into making the bread. But to sell the actual thing itself, the balabas should be selling it himself rather than going through middlemen, because that'll keep prices low, and that way people will be able to afford these things. However, Amru Olav Rav Elazar ben Azariah shayv sack of yain b'shemen. However, they said on Rav Elazar ben Azariah that he used to make a profit on wine and on oil. Now, why is that? How could he do that? The answer is b'yayin savalar k'Rav Yehuda. When it comes to wine, he holds that Rav Yehuda ben Seder, just like we said before, ma'ayv sakikla, better to have less wine around, so therefore no problem causing the prices of it to rise, because, okay, people will be able to afford less of that. Good. That way there'll be less tifla. The shemen, what about oil? The astra, Rav Elazar ben Azariah, Shriach Mishka. In Rav Elazar ben Azariah's area, in Israel, it so happened that oil was very plentiful, and therefore there wasn't an issue that if he makes a profit on it, the poor people won't be able to afford it. The prices were so cheap for oil that anybody could afford it anyway.
He was where in the north?
I don't know. I don't know where Rav Elazar ben Azariah lived. Yeah, but all over Eretz Yisrael, you have lots of olive trees. So, yeah. Okay, turn it up, Donovan. Yeah, hello. In Mistakrim Pamayim Bebeisi, you're not allowed to make a double profit on eggs. So what does that mean, a double profit? Omer Mori Bar Mori, Pligi Bar Rav Shmuel. Rav and Shmuel argue, what is Pamayim Bebeisi? What does it mean twice? Chad Omer Achadre, one of them, either Rav or Shmuel, says it means you're not allowed to mark them up by 100%. So if you bought a dinar's worth of eggs, you're not allowed to sell them for 2 dinarim. You can sell them for less than that, but not 2 dinarim. Now, what about the 1/6? We'll talk about it in a second. Chad Omer Tagra L'Tagra. The other opinion is that it means you shouldn't have one middleman sell to another. In the case of other things, Yenis, Shmonim, Aslosis, we said before, you shouldn't have any middlemen at all, at least in Eretz Yisrael. With eggs, you're allowed to have a middleman, but you shouldn't have two middlemen, because then each one, because one is going to raise the prices a little bit. He has to make some kind of profit. But you have two, then the price is going to go up a great deal.
Nor is Israel one.
No, not at all. Like, you have these. We're not talking about, again, we're not talking about like nowadays where you have huge conglomerates or whatever. We're talking about in those days, you would have, a person just goes, the Rashbam describes, you have a poor person who goes around in the cities and buys eggs from whoever has them available. So it's a little local market. So fine, for him to buy the eggs from the farmers and resell them, that's fine, it'll make a profit. But for him to resell them to somebody else, who will then sell them to somebody else, who will sell them to the consumers, that you shouldn't do. Because then each one, the person himself who originally buys the eggs from the farmers, is going to have to get his cut. The storekeeper who buys from him is going to have to get his cut, and by the time it gets to the end consumer, the price will be much higher.
So
what's the difference about eggs? Before we said 1/6 in general.
True.
So Tosfos says two things. First of all, again, when we said yesterday a sixth means 20%, that meant exclusive of your labor and whatever. Here we're talking about even if you factor in the labor and all, it shouldn't be as much as double. It shouldn't be as much as double the original price. Also, Tosfos brings another explanation that it means, even let's say, so fine, we're not talking about you bought eggs from somebody else. You're selling eggs from your own house,
right?
You're selling eggs from your own chicken. If it was other kinds of things, you would be allowed to make more of a profit on it. But because in this case it's eggs, then therefore we're putting a limitation on it and saying because eggs are not quite as basic a necessity as Yenis, Shimonim, and Slosses, but nevertheless they are somewhat of a necessity. So the halacha is actually brought in Shulchan Aruch, which we started talking about this yesterday. There's a number of different factors involved over here. on the one hand, so we're saying when it comes to Yenus Shemona Maslosas, you're not supposed to make a profit of more than 20%. And in Eretz Yisrael, not even that, we're saying, because you want it, you know, Eretz Yisrael, you want it to be more plentiful for people. Unless, again, you're talking about something like oil, which is very unless you're talking about something which is very easily and cheaply available, then you're allowed to mark it up. You have a second category of things such as eggs, which are not quite such staples, but they're not luxury goods either. Those you can make more of a profit, but not as much as double, as the Gemara is saying over here. And then you have things that we talked about yesterday, like spices. Those you can charge, with those you can no. Spices aren't plentiful, but spices aren't really a necessity either. They're a luxury good, therefore those you can charge whatever you want for. And we said also there's other considerations as well, such as if everybody else in town is selling, or everybody else in that area is selling for at whatever markup they want, they're not following these rules in the Gemara, then you, the particular storekeeper, are not obligated to follow these rules either. We don't expect you to sell lower than everybody else in order to comply with the rules in the Gemara here. And also, there's another exception that it mentions in Shulchan Aruch. What if the base price of things has gone up? So originally, so you're dealing in egg. Egg maybe isn't a good example. They're very perishable. Let's say you're talking about something not quite so perishable. Oh, let's say wine or oil or whatever. Let's say wine, flour, whatever. Yeah, anything that lasts a while. So originally, let's say you bought a consignment of flour where the going price at the time was, I don't know, $3 for a 5-pound bag. Since then, the price has gone up, and now the going price in the stores is $4 is $4 for a 5-pound bag. You're allowed to do that markup as well, and you know that doesn't factor in towards your 20% or whatever.
Okay. Because it's not a prime.
Because it's not just you're not just doing it in order to make a profit. You're doing it because that's the new price. Once you sell your flour and you're going to have to buy more flour, you're going to also be buying at the new price, the new wholesale price maybe, but it's still going to be a higher wholesale price than it was before.
So I'm not sure. What's the distinction between when you buy from the wholesale price and what?
Okay, again, you're a flour dealer. Let's say you buy a 100-pound bag of you buy a 100-pound bag of flour for $100. Let's say. And that's the going rate at the time. And then you parcel out into 5-pound bags, and you sell each 5-pound bag, let's say for six dollars, you said 20%, so you sell it for $6. Now let's say though, as you're going through this 100-pound bag of flour, the price has gone up. Now if you were to buy another 100-pound bag of flour, the price would be 110. You're allowed to mark up. You don't have to be selling your 5-pound bag of flour for $6 anymore. You can be selling them for $6.50 or whatever the proportionate amount is. I'm not saying the exact proportions, but you get the idea. The fact that the base price has gone up entitles you to raise your prices as well.
To raise it, but to raise it in which proportion?
To raise it in proportion to what to the increase. So yeah, but in other words, 10% then. Okay, so instead of selling the bag of flour for $6 now, you'll be selling it for $6.60. That's the idea. There's an interesting tshuva from Ramosha Feinstein where he says this kind of rule about not overcharging for things applies to other things that people need as a basic thing also. So he talks about a case of a funeral home that jacked up their prices for funerals, and he says based on this Gemara, that's wrong. Eventually everybody needs that after 120, you can't do that. And he says, therefore, if somebody else wants to undercut them on price, you don't have to let them. Tananabonim. Matrian apragmatia. You cry out in davening.
It seems a bit contradictory to say that you cannot increase the prices, but at the same time you inhibit competition, what we saw the other day.
Where did we see that you inhibit competition?
You cannot have several people do the same thing at the same place.
We learned in the second paragraph. Yes, it's true. There is a certain amount of rules about that because you don't want to completely cut off the other. But it's not so. We did say that there are exceptions over there. We did say that it's allowed under certain circumstances. We talked about that wasn't recently. It was back in the second paragraph. But yeah, we talked about it. There is a matter of hasagas rule, but there's rules within that also. It's not so simple. Sometimes there's some under some circumstances it is allowed. Under some circumstances it's not. Okay. Turn it up on matrin or pragmatia. We cry out in davening about pragmatia, about merchandise, shahuzla, hagoyta bahad, which is too cheap. Afkila b'shabbos, and you can even do that on Shabbos. In other words, what's happening is, for example, the Rashbam gives an example. So let's say you're talking about fine clothes. The fact that normally the price of them is high, that's not a big problem for the aniyim. They don't buy those kinds of clothes anyway. If the price of them has gone down so far that it's causing an economic crisis, then you can cry out and davening on that even on Shabbos.
Really?
Yeah. An example would be linen garments in Bavel, which again is not the kind of thing that the poor people typically buy. V'yayin v'shemen v'eretz Yisrael, and wine and oil in Eretz Yisrael, which it's not necessarily. I mean, the Rashbam understands it to be basically that it's a problem with not, that the thing is it's not a hefsid for the aniyim, even if it becomes cheaper. Even if it's more expensive, I meant, yeah. There are other Mephoshim who say that, no, what it is, it's true, for example, I mean, poor people do buy clay fish, then they do buy wine and oil, but if you have, as the Gemara is going to say now, as the Gemara is saying over here, if these are things that the local economy depends on those, this is their primary staple that everybody makes a living from, if the price of it goes so down that nobody is making a profit, it's going to be bad for the poor people as well. It's nice to have deflation. It helps the poor people. It makes a dollar will stretch further for them, but not if it means that the whole economic basis of the area is falling apart. So that's what we're talking about. Amar Rav Yosef, who dissolve a kamasara b'shita. This is only, we're talking about that the prices have gone so far down that something where usually you would buy, for example, 10 of these clothes, now that usually the price you would pay for 6 of these clothes now buys 10 of them. So the prices have gone down by 40%, almost half. That's the kind of thing we're talking about when it's an economic crisis, that's something that therefore it's appropriate to daven and cry out for when davening even on Shabbos. Coming up on another braisa on the topic of prices going up or down. You're not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz-Lartz, unless prices have gone up so much that it takes us that you can buy 2 saw for a seller. Normally in Shas, the usual assumption is that you can buy 4 saw of wheat for 1 seller. One seller per dinner. One saw per dinner. 4 saw of wheat for 1 seller. It's a saw is about 20, is about 20 pounds, a bushel, let's say. A sella would be, I don't know, a sella, I mean, a sella is not really directly translated. I mean, it would be the equivalent of a silver dollar, but money went a lot further then than it does now, so it's not really directly comparable.
What are we talking about?
So whatever, we're talking about that was the normal price, was that you could buy 4 saw for a sella.
So now today,
I don't know, but again, you know, our economy isn't
bushel,
the same.
A bushel of flour?
A bushel of wheat, let's say.
Wheat.
But I don't know if it's directly translatable into modern terms, because again, you know, our economy is different. I understand, but you know, people don't usually buy and sell bushels of wheat, because people usually just buy ready-made flour. So like this, the point is that the prices have gone up, the price of wheat or whatever is twice as much as it usually is. And under those circumstances, you would be allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael. Otherwise, no. The Rashbam says the reason is because if you leave Eretz Yisrael, you're taking yourself away from doing mitzvahs. You have mitzvahs that you can only do in Eretz Yisrael, Trumas, Maisvahs, Shmita, or whatever. You're not going to be able to do them in Chutz Lartz. The Ramban argues with the Rambam on the we know that Rambam wrote Sefer HaMitzvahs. He has a list of the 613 mitzvahs. The Ramban argues with him on a number of them and says there are certain ones that the Rambam counted as mitzvahs that shouldn't be separate mitzvahs and vice versa. One of the supplementary ones, which the Ramban says should have been counted, is the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael. Evidently, the Rambam apparently doesn't consider it one of the 613 mitzvahs, either because he says it's only a Hechsher mitzvah. It's not specifically a mitzvah per se to live in Eretz Yisrael, just like the Rashbam says over here, without that you can't be doing certain mitzvahs, or because the Rambam holds it only applied in certain times. Whatever it is, the Ramban seems to hold that it's a mitzvah in all times.
The Ramban lived
in Spain most of his life, then towards the end of his life he moved to Eretz Yisrael. Okay, anyway.
On the Rambam?
The Rambam briefly visited Eretz Yisrael, and apparently he didn't live there. Now. Okay, onward.
What's the halacha?
The halacha is that there is an inyan to live in Eretz Yisrael. We talked about it at the end of Ksubas, but there are exceptions. And the fact is, most of the poskim hold with the Rambam that at least with the apparent meaning of the Rambam, that the mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael is really only applicable, at least midaraisa, only when there's a bis mikdash and therefore there's aliyah l'regel and so forth. Not necessarily now. There's still an inyan to live there for other reasons, like the Rashbam says you can do mitzvahs at Lois Baret, but it's not the same thing. Okay, anyway, onward. The Omer of Shimon, Amosai, Rav Shimon says, when is this talking about that you'd be allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael because of a rise in prices? Bizman she'enem moitzel likach. if you're not able to find anything to buy. So there's a shortage, and therefore either you don't have money, or either you don't have money to be able to buy at those prices, or there's a shortage of grain or whatever. Alba was mancha moitzim likach, but if there is grain available to buy, afilo under sa v'sela lo yetzei, then you shouldn't leave, even if a sa is selling for one sell, I mean four times the usual price. So there's two basic understandings of what Reb Shimon is saying. Is he saying that never mind matters of rises and prices, the only excuse you can have to leave is any moitzim likach, especially no grain available? Or is Reb Shimon saying that you need both? You need there to be a rise in prices and that there's no grain available. Those are other issues. We're talking about when it's not an issue of learning Torah or getting married or whatever. Other than that, a valid reason to leave Eretz Yisrael, according to the Tanakhama, would be if there's a rise in prices, to double the usual amount. And according to Reb Shimon, only if there's no food available to buy, or according to the other explanation, that there's no food and that it's very pricey and there's nothing to buy. Okay. And so also we find Reb Shimon ben Yochai used to say, here's an example of how serious it is to leave Eretz Yisrael because of famine. Eli Melech Machlin Machlin Bekilin Gedolei Ador Hayu. Eli Melech from the Book of Ruth. And his sons Machlin and Kilion were great people of the generation. Upanose Ador Hayu, and they were leaders of the generation. So why were they punished? And then Megillas Ruth tells the story. They left Eretz Yisrael because of a famine. The Elimelech, his wife Naomi, and their two sons Machlon and Kilion, they settled in Moab. Elimelech died there. Eventually Machlon and Kilion die there also. They lose all their money, the Medrash says. Why were they punished so severely? Because they left Eretz Yisrael for Chutzlaret. So therefore, Reb Shimon is saying, you see what a serious thing. There was a famine then, and they left, and doctor held to account. That's what Reb Shimon is saying. That even if it's a matter of prices are high, you shouldn't be leaving. Because you see, in their case, there was a famine, prices were high, there was food able to be gotten, especially they were rich people. They had food available, but they chose to leave, and therefore that was a problem. As the Pasuk says, Vatehen Kol Ha'ir Aleihem, the entire city, when Naomi and Ruth come back to Beit Lechem, the whole city is in an uproar because of them. They're all not really in uproar, they're all surprised. Vatehen Meloshen Homam, Meloshen, like making noise, like everybody's in a tumult because of them. Vatehmauna Hazois Naomi, and they said, is this Naomi? My Hazois Naomi, what do you mean Hazois Naomi? Amr Rabbi Yitzchak Amru, they said, Hazisem Naomi, have you seen this Naomi Shiyotas Me'eret L'Chutzlaret, that she left from Eretz Yisrael L'Chutzlaret? Ma'otha, well, look what happened to her. Her husband died, her children died, she's poor, etc. Marsha takes out of here the word, Naomi was the wife of Elimelech. She was Ruth's mother-in-law.
Ruth's mother-in-law.
Yes. Now, what's the Shenemar doing over here? The Marsha says one possibility is we should take out the word Shenemar. The pasuk over here is not proving anything about the seriousness of going from Eretz Yisrael to Chutzlaret. So he takes out the Shenemar. It's a new thing. Once we establish that they were punished because of leaving Eretz Yisrael to Chutzlaret, then we have a new drasha. The Gemara is saying that when it says they came back and everybody was all in a tizzy, look what happened, means they're saying look what happened to her for leaving Eretz Yisrael to Chutzlaret. But not directly. It's not a proof to the previous thing. It's a separate thing. There's other explanations. There's other explanations, including that one of them is that since the pasuk says Kol Ha'ir, based on a medrash, the implication is the entire city had survived the famine. So therefore, in other words, we see they stayed in Eretz Yisrael through the famine, and they wished to help, they all survived. Elimelech and his family left, and to be out of the four of them are dead. So according to that, that's the proof of it. So now we're going to talk a little bit about the story, about various details in the story of Ruth and Boaz and Naomi and that whole story from Megillas Ruth. This way also, you know, in a few weeks' time, we're going to be saying Tikkun Leil Shavuos. We say Megillas Ruth during Tikkun Leil Shavuos. Now you'll have a little bit of background for what it says in the Pesukim of it. V'amar Rav Yitzchak, Oysa Yom Shabbos Ruth HaMoyavim L'Eretz Yisrael. That same day that Ruth from Moav came to Eretz Yisrael, Meitzu Ishtesho Boaz. Boaz's first wife died. As a matter of fact, the Mefarshim say, based on the Medrash, that's when the Pasuk says, Vatehen Kol Ha'ir Aleihem, what do you mean the whole city was in a tizzy about them? What's the whole city doing out with to see Naomi and Ruth coming? Because they were all there to by the Levaya of Boaz's wife. And therefore, and all of a sudden, they see Naomi and Ruth coming up the path. Oh, look at that.
Coming back.
Yeah. So V'hainu da'amrig, and see, this is like the expression. People say, Abdullah shochev shichva, before even a person has passed away, kaima manu baise. The person who's going to be next in charge of his house is already standing up. In other words, like this, Boaz's wife passed away, and already Ruth, who's going to be Boaz's next wife, is already on her way to Beit Lechem. Is already coming into Beit Lechem. So that's kind of like the Zorach HaShemesh of HaShemesh, the Abish to prepare the cure before the disease. So before Boaz's wife even dies, Ruth is already on her way there.
She knew what the
thing? No, of course she didn't know, but eventually that's the Abish to work these things out. Amar Rav Bar Avuna, Amar Rav, Ivson Zeboyaz, Ivson is the name of one of the Shoftim, and it was still in Sefer Shoftim. He is the same as Boaz. That's the question, Maya Kamash Malon. What are we supposed to learn from that? What are we gaining from that? That we know that we're identifying Ivson as Boaz. The answer is Ki'idach to Rav Bar Avuna. It helps us understand. It helps us with something else that Rav Bar Avuna said. Do Amar Rav Bar Avuna Amar Rav Meya Ve'Esrim Mishtois Also Boaz Labona. Boaz made 120 feasts for his children for significant events in their life. Shenema, the pasuk says, about Ivson. Vayila shloshim bonim, he had 30 sons.
Ushamami one?
I don't know, it doesn't say. Ushloshim bonim shilach achutza. He also had 30 daughters whom he sent out, meaning that he married them off to people from other towns. Yeah, we see in Megillas Ruth that he was very rich, yeah. You see from the back, Ruth is going over there and collecting leket in his fields, and from one day she's collecting quite a large amount of leket, and she's working by him all through the season. Yeah, we see over there in the
circle. Was rich.
I don't know. From investments. I don't know.
What?
Lottery.
Yeah. From Apple stock. I don't know. All right. So he had 30 sons, or Shloshim Bonas Shilach Achutza. He had 30 daughters who he sent out, meaning that he married them off to people from other, to men from other families. So they're sent out of his house. They leave his house to go live in their new places. Or Shloshim Bonas Hevel Bonav Menachot. He brought in 30 girls for his son from his sons. And he married off each of his. So he married off each of his sons. He married off each of his daughters. So he made 60 weddings. The apostle says he judged the Jewish people for 7 years. So we have 60 children, 60 chasinus. Over chol achas v'achas, also shtei mishtois. For each one of these children, he made two parties. Echad beveis aviv ve'echad beveis chomer. One in his father's house, which is the sudas erusin, and the other one, the sudas nisuin, in the father-in-law's house, in his mechotanim's house. Or Rabbeinu Gershom has a different girsa, apparently, one when they were born and one when they got married. But here's a source in the Gemara, by the way, for a Shalom Zachar for a boy and a Kiddush for a girl. Okay, so you see then that he made 120 parties. He had 60 children, two parties for each one makes 120.
Did he remember all the names of his grandchildren?
wait. Okay.
He was from Eretz Yisrael.
Yeah, of course he was from Eretz Yisrael. He was from Beit Lachem. Yeah. Now, however, he did not invite Manoach, who later on was the father of Shimshon, to any of these 120 parties. Why not? Omar, because he said, this infertile mule, how would he pay me back? Meaning, we know from the Pesukim, we know from the story of Shimshon, which is shortly after this description of Ivson in the Pesukim over there, we know that Manoach and his wife were infertile, they were childless for many years until the Malach came to Manoach's wife, we'll see her name soon in the Gemara, and told her she's going to have a child, and he's going to be a Nazir, etc. We know the beginning of the story is that Torah of Parshas Nazir. So the Boaz felt, it's not like Manoach has any way of paying me back. Why should I invite him to any... Okay, so what's the Haitachan? A tzaddik like this son, Boaz, should say such a thing. Okay, so there's a couple of different explanations. Marsha says what it means is that we're going to learn later in the Masechta, we're going to learn in the Kuf Mems about the concept of Shushvinu, that there's a certain kind of thing. It's primarily with weddings, which is what we're talking about over here, where you invite people to your wedding and they help, and then later on the expectation is that they're going to invite you to their simchas, and it's actually considered a monetary obligation. We'll learn in the ninth pedic. We'll learn
that already.
Okay, we may have talked about it briefly. We haven't gotten into the nuts and bolts of it yet. We'll do that later on in the ninth pedic. But it is. It's considered an actual monetary obligation. It can, to a certain extent, it can be enforced in basis.
To return the... about it regarding ribbon.
I don't remember. Yeah, we may. Yeah, we, I think we did actually. Yeah, I think you're right. I think we may have talked about it regarding ribbons. That it's not. That it's not. That even if I make a party where it's $20 a plate, you make a party of $30 a plate. It's not ribbons for you to be repaying the shushubinos with that. It's not considered. It's not considered ribbons.
We didn't say that it was an obligation to.
So we didn't get into. We didn't get into the nuts and bolts of it. We'll do that later. But that's the. That's
we didn't
the
pull anyway.
Yeah. No, so the point is, Marsha says, therefore, so Boaz took the view, well, so if I invite him to these parties, he's going to have to reciprocate. It's going to be an obligation halacha for him to reciprocate. He can't. He doesn't have any children. So in that case, better not, let me not put that responsibility on him in the first place. There's a couple of other explanations. Ben Yahya says that what it is not that he's saying, he's not that he's calling him or names like that. He didn't want to invite him. He didn't want to hurt his feelings. The guy, poor guy, you're going to invite him to your son, to your kid's house, and the poor guy has no kids of his own. But he should have at least explained to Manoach why he's doing that. Instead, he didn't, and Manoach felt bad about it. That was the problem. And then there's a third explanation.
That would be fairly obvious, wouldn't it? That if you don't invite someone to your wedding, he was very close to him.
But we don't know how close they were, but the point is he should have explained to him. And then there's a third explanation in Iyun Yaakov based on the Gemara in Brachas that says that Manoach was an Amoritz. So we learned earlier in the Masechta that we learned that Rebbe didn't want to give food, his food to an Amoritz. Boaz, his son, may have felt the same way. Therefore, he didn't invite him. Okay. It does, but on the other hand, as we learned, there is an inyan to not. Fine, an Amoritz, you're not going to let him starve, of course. But there's no. You don't necessarily need to be inviting him to share from your food. You give him stucca as necessary. We don't necessarily need to be inviting him to your party. But again, Manoach's not inviting anybody to any of his weddings because he doesn't have any children. Okay, onward. Let's continue. Tana. We learn in a brisa of a kulan mesa b'chayav. We learn in a brisa that all those 60 children died while Boaz was still alive. So you're asking, was he able to keep track of all his grandchildren? Sounds like he didn't have them.
That's probably the result.
It's possible that it may be a concern. I mean, the Rashbam says we're not even go to Tana. That's not even a separate brisa. Rava Barahona is continuing that he didn't invite Manoach and all these children died in his lifetime. I mean, yeah. Okay. Well, we're not saying that he did right, but we're okay. Anyway.
But we're saying it as a consequence.
Right? Yeah, okay, yeah. In other words, so we're saying not necessarily. What if son Boaz did was not necessarily the right thing to do? Yeah, okay. He may have had his reasons, but it was still not the right thing to do. Okay, anyway. Now, what do we have afterwards, though? So Boaz, his 60 children are dead. His first wife died, we just said before. But what happens afterwards? He marries Ruth, and they have one more child, Obed, who is the grandfather of David. This is like the expression. People say, even if you had 60 children while you were alive, what good are those 60 going to do for you? They may eventually, if they end up dying during the person's lifetime, like they did by Boaz, what have you accomplished? Yeah. Instead, what you should do is continue. Ichbal means continue. Literally means double. In other words, try again. Remarry, but you'll have one child who may be better, who may be better than all the 60. Namely, what happened? Boaz in the end has one child, Obed, who becomes the grandfather of David HaMelech and the ancestor of all the Jewish kings and so forth. He outweighed all the 60 who he had before he made his 120 parties for. So we see that the Indian, that you have many children when you're younger, but still, you never know the one that you have, the one child that you have. David was the son of Yishai, was the son of Obed.
So
this is David is the grandson of Obed. It's one child who was born to Boaz and Ruth. Great grandson of David. Shmuel. Obed was born when Boaz married Ruth.
Yeah.
Ruth conceived the child that she gave birth to. They named Obed, and he is the grandfather of David. Who Avi Yishai, Avi David, it says in Megillah Sur. Yeah. So that's the point, that the one child that he has outweighs all the 60 from before. Rashbam brings another explanation that the one child over here refers to Shibshon, who, with his strength, he outweighs all the 60 from before. Rashbam says he doesn't like that explanation. I've been a Gershon.
Did he leave children?
Doesn't say whether he did or not, but whatever. The point is, Shibshon, on the other hand, he had accomplishments that outweighed the 60 children of Boaz. But on the other hand, but to be said, all those 60 children died. Shimshon, he fought against the Plishtim. But it's a tremendous accomplishment what he did against the Plishtim in his time. That's
not a great accomplishment.
Okay, so that's Maybe that's why the Rashbam says, I don't like that explanation. Be that as it may, Rabbeinu Gershon brings that's what the Gemara means. All right, onward. Simon, Melech Avraham, Esther, Shonim, Shenifter, Nisnati, Levadai. Again, these are keywords of each of several veritlach that the Gemara is going to bring now on different topics related to these things. Number one, Amar of Chanan bar Rava Amar Rav. Actually, what it is these are all statements that Rav Chanan bar Rava brings in the name of Rav. So therefore, we're going to start with one that relates to what we were saying before about Elimelech and his family, and then we're going to segue into other things. Elimelech v'Salmon u'Pliny Almoni v'Avi Nomi Kulan b'nei Nachshon min Aminadav. Elimelech, the father of Machlon and Kilian and Sefer Rus, Nomi's husband, Salmon, who is the father of Boaz, at the end of Megillas Rus, when it lists David Yuchsin over there, it says you have Nachshon, you have Salyah, who had a son Salmon, who had a son Boaz. So Elimelech, Salmon, Uplaini Almoni. Maybe it's related, I don't know. Uplaini Almoni. Actually, I think the Medrash says it's Meloshon Sulam, a ladder, because he's like a step in the ladder towards Malchus Beis David.
That anyway. Gave an end to Salman?
No, not directly. Okay. Uplaini Almoni. In Megillas Rus, you have the story over there that Boaz, Ruth says to Boaz, you know, you have to marry me. You're the closest relative who's allowed to up your law, so you have to do it. Lahakim lahakim shame. You're not the brother of the Nifter, but in those times, the Ramban explains, the other Rishonim explain, they knew the value of Yibum, and therefore, aside from the fact that Torah says the mitzvah of Yibum, for a brother of the mess, in this case, there is none. Machlon and Kilian are both dead, but they would still do it with other relatives also where it's allowed up each other.
Who was what it happened?
According to this that we're saying over here, that Salmon, Boaz's father, is a brother of Elimelech, then yes, it means that Boaz is the cousin of Machlon and Kilian. Yeah. So she says to him, you have to marry me, or your closest relative. He says, you should know there's a closer relative. Who is that closer relative? In Perek Dalet of Rus, it says over there, he called Pliny Almoni. Pliny Almoni means the anonymous one. The Medrash says he was called Toyev. Anyway, he's another brother, so therefore, so Boaz tells her he's actually a closer relative than I am. I'll ask him if he wants to marry you. If he does, then he has first rights, because he's an uncle of Machlon and Kilian, and he's a closer relative than I, who am a cousin. If he doesn't want to, then I'll be next in line. He asks him, the guy says, I don't want to, and so Boaz ends up marrying you. So that's pointing on money.
The guy said he doesn't want to.
Ba'avin Nomi and the father of Nomi, Kulun b'nei Nachshon min Aminadav, these were all children of Nachshon min Aminadav. Which means, by the way, that it comes out that Elimelech and Nomi then themselves are cousins also. Elimelech and Nomi, the husband and wife, Elimelech is the son of one, Elimelech rather and the father of Nomi. No, rather he married his niece, sorry. Nomi is the niece of Elimelech. Yeah. Okay. Again, the question is, my Kamash Malon, what's the point of telling us this family tree? The point is, Shaftulu Mishiyash L'Schus Ovet, Enei Medes L'Rishal Shiyotze Me'eret L'Chutzlare. Even somebody who has Schus of their ancestors, like this, they're all descended from Nachshon and the great Nachshon Min Aminadav, and then Machlon and Kilian, then we see from here, are descended from Nachshon Min Aminadav on both sides. Their father is a son of Nachshon Min Aminadav. Their mother is a granddaughter of Nachshon Min Aminadav. Even all that Schus didn't help them, B'Shal Shiyotze Me'eret L'Chutzlare, because if you leave Eretz Yisrael L'Chutzlare, because we see they passed away. So these are all descendants of Nachshon. Once we're living there, you're allowed to leave out the job for Chutzlar to study, to get married, and as we said before, in the Gemara, there's problems with Parnassah in Eretz Yisrael. Yeah.
Even here, there's problems with Parnassah, and they still got punished.
Yeah, but that's what Reb Shimon was saying before. Since the that conditions weren't so bad as to be in the situation where Reb Shimon says you'd be allowed to leave for Chutzlaret, therefore they were punished. Had conditions been worse, then they would have been fine. Reb Shimon was saying. We'll learn on Amud Beis. We'll learn another opinion on the subject. But for now, this is what we got.
The
halacha is like a chachamim, not like Reb Shimon. So as long as prices are double what they are usually, then you're allowed to leave.
So you got screwed.
Okay, there you go. All right, let's go on. The name of Abraham's mother is Amaslai Bas Karnavoy. And the mother of Haman is also named Amaslai, but the daughter of Aravdi. The Simonach, and the way to remember which one is which, Tomei, Tahar, Tahar. The Tomei comes from the Tomei, the Tahar comes from the Tahar. Namely, the word Karnavoy, which is the name of Avraham's grandfather, it has in it the word Kar, which means sheep. which are tahar animals. A ravdi means a raven, which is a tereva bird. So that helps us remember that Abraham comes from Karnavoy, and Haman comes, which is tahar, and Haman, who's tame, comes from a flying about a ravdi, the raven, yeah, which is tahar. The name of David's mother is Nitzeves Basadol. Image of Shimshon Slelponis. The mother of Shimshon is named Slelponis. Vachose Nashian. And his sister, apparently we see from this Gemara that Shimshon had a sister, even though it's not specific from the Pesukim that he did. He had a sister named Nashian. Okay, the question is, Lamai Nafkamina, why is it important to know these details? The reason is Lashuva Taminim. It helps us answer and refute the Minim. Meaning, in other words, like this. So the Rashbam says, like this, people, the Minim might ask, for example. So let's say, for example, we know the names of the mothers of Yitzchak and Yaakov and the Shvatim. What's the name of Abraham's mother? You don't know her. You don't even know your own history. If we know the names of the mothers of all the kings of Yehuda. What's the name of David? Same kind of thing. Shimshon's mother, we have her over and over in the Pesukim over there. We have a whole perek that tells the whole story of her and Manoah. Doesn't say her name. So like this, we have an answer for them. Yes, we have names for them. The Rimi Gash says another explanation of it. He says, we tell them like this. You minim think you can only believe in Teresh B'Sav. If you look only in Teresh B'Sav, you're not going to have any of these names. How do you know them? Only from Teresh B'Peh. Once you admit that those kinds of things you can only know from Teresh B'Peh, and we know them, then you have to accept that the rest of Teresh B'Peh is also true.
When you know them from Teresh B'Peh?
We know, because we have our Gemara right here. Says. I'm a fly by carnivore, car, Tomei as in Haman, with a Tomei person. No, by Haman's time there were, but the point is. Because it means Abraham is Tahar, Haman is Tomei. Oh, okay, fine. But the point is, no, not that his grandfather was Tahar, but his grandfather has a name, has a kosher name. It's named after car, which means. His grand, I'm a fly by Karnavoy, where Kar is a sheep. So that helps us remember that the Tahar, Abraham, comes from a name of a person who has a Tahar name. No, we're not talking about that. Anyway, the Chassam Sofer gives another interesting explanation of what it means, L'tshuvas HaMinim. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin that tells that the Minim used to make, like Menashe, for example, Menashe Melech Yehuda used to do this, for example. Other Minim would make fun of, why does the Torah have such irrelevant details in it? For example, the Torah tells us V'achos Loitam Timna, that there was a woman Timna from the family of Seir, who eventually married into Esav's family. Why is it important for us to know? Sam, the Torah is just telling us this, telling us seemingly nonsensical things. So we tell them like this. We tell them, based on this Gemara over here, what we tell them is, look, we see the Torah didn't mention things like the name of Abraham of his mother or the name of David's mother or whatever, even though you would think those are useful details to know. Why? Because the Torah's not out to just give us useful details that are nice to know. If the Torah tells us the name of a person, it has a reason. There's a reason behind it. In the case of Achot Loitam Timna, there's a reason behind it. It teaches us she's a princess from the family of Seir, but she said instead of being a princess from Seir, I'll become a shifa, I'll become a kulegesh to Esav's family because he's descended from Abraham, and Yitzchak because he's descended from Abraham. So there's a purpose to it. As opposed to, there was no purpose to tell us the name of Abraham and his mother, or the name of David's mother, or whatever, and therefore the Torah didn't write. The Gemara tells us there's a purpose from the point of view of Torah about that, but there's not a purpose from the point of view of Torah about that. I should mention, by the way, as an interesting thing, Reb Levick, the Rebbe's father, has an interesting explanation in a couple of places. So we're saying over here we're putting Haman specifically opposed to Abraham. They both have the same mother's name, but they have different grandfather's names. He says that if you look a little more deeply into it, you find they are kind of opposites in many ways. For example, the Gemara tells us in Megillah that according to one opinion, Haman had 208 children, Beroy was matched with 208. Abraham had the one son Yitzchak, which is Gematria, 208. Haman begins with Haman. Abraham ends with that. Abraham has founded the Jewish people. Haman wanted to destroy it, and so it's opposite. Abraham Avinu was in jail for 10 years, meaning, as Rashbam says, Nimrod put him in jail. Before the whole thing with the fiery furnace, he put him in jail for many years. Or, because he was angry at him, he's breaking the idols, he's challenging him, etc. Then the Rashbam brings another explanation that Terach put him in jail. After the famous story that we all learned as little kids, that he broke his father's idol, Terach was so mad at him that he put him in jail. So 10 years, Sholosh b'Kusa v'Sheva b'Kaudu, 3 in the city of Kusa and 7 in Kaudu. Rabdimi Minadol learned it the other way around. That was first in Kaudu, then in Kusa, or maybe that was 7 in Kusa and 3 in Kaudu, whatever. Amr of Chista, so Rav Chista says, by the way, you should know, Ibra, the Ira, the Kusa, they were captain. The small path by Kusa, Kusa was the name of the city in Babel, the small pass near that city, Zeru Urkastim. That is the Urkastim. That's the place where the fiery furnace was that Abraham was saved from. The point of it is, if you pass by that area, you have to say the bracha, Baruch Shas and Nisim Lavasin and Bamakam Azim.
Do we know where it is?
We know where the city of Kusa is. I don't know, someplace in northern Iraq or something. Do we know exactly where Ibra the Ira is? Probably not. I don't know. For Amr of Chanan Bar Rava Amr Rav, the day that Avraham Avinu passed away, all the great leaders of the nation stood in a line, like to accept Nichum Avelim, because they were all in mourning for him. But Amru, and they said, woe is it to the world that lost its leader. And woe to the ship that lost its captain. They all recognized that Avraham Avinu had been their leader and their captain. Why the double expression? There's a few different explanations. Marshall says because he taught them about the Abishon, and he also taught them Midas Tovus. There's another explanation that he taught them about the Abishon, and he also taught them about practical governance. And there's a few different that he taught them for the Rabbim and for the Yachta. There's a few different explanations about the dual thing that he accomplished. Another next statement. The Pasuk says, Amisnase l'chol l'roish. The Pasuk says that the Abishon raises up every kind of head. What does that mean? Amar Rav Chanan bar Rava, Amar Rav. After the Reish Gargutza, it means even somebody who has who has a certain position of authority, but it's a very low position. The person who's in charge of deciding who gets to water their fields on which day. So it's like the smallest authority you could possibly imagine. Even that Mishmaya Moitmile, even that kind of thing is appointed Min Hashemayim. That's Amisnase, every kind of thing where somebody is raised up above everybody else, even for a small thing, the Rosh, they become the head, is done by you, by the Amishter. But okay, all right. So those are all the statements. Those are all the statements that Ochanan bar Rava brought in the name of Rav. That's why we had a
statement. By that thinking, you say that. An evil man that came to power, also done by the
Eibishter? Sometimes, yes. Not sometimes. I mean, the Eibishter runs the world, yes. So sometimes we know why it is that the Eibishter brought them in power in order that then their downfall will be all the greater. Haman is a classic example of that.
Their downfall was not as big as that. No, but whatever.
The Eibishter had his reasons for putting them in power. I don't know. We don't know completely how the Eibishter runs the world, but yeah. Okay. Onward. Okay. Getting back to, we said on Amud Aleph about Machlon and Kilion and Elimelech, we said that they were wrong in leaving Eretz Yisrael, and because of that, they were punished. Now, continuing on that, Amud Abishuman Kofa, Chas B'Shalom to say that that's why they were punished, Shafu L'motu Subin Lo Yotu. But guess, they didn't just leave because, even though there was plenty of food available and just there was a famine and prices were high. Even if all they found was bran, they wouldn't have left. If they left, it must mean the situation was really desperate. The Taka had justification and halacha to leave. The Elam of Neiman Nenshu, so why Taka were they punished? Shahila, Mvakish Rachim, Abdurim, Vladikshu, because they should have davened for Rachmim, for their generation. They should have davened that the famine should end, and they didn't. Shanema, the Pasuk says, Vazaakech Yatiluch Kibbutzayach. When you cry out, said Eivishter, for those who are gathered together, you will be saved. In other words, like this, where they should have davened on behalf of the assembled Jewish people, and they would have been saved, and everybody would have been saved. They didn't, therefore they were punished.
And so the Jewish people.
What? The rest of the Jewish people had a famine. The famine just continued because nobody davened for it to stop. But Machlon and Kilion, and Elimelech, sure.
They didn't think it davened themselves.
Apparently, we said on Amud Aleph, Machlon and Kilion looked dirty at earth. They were great tzaddikim. We're saying, yeah. At least at the beginning, yeah. Okay. Now getting back to the halacha that we had on Amud Aleph. We said that you're not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael unless prices are unusually high, twice as much or four times as much, or you can't find anything to buy or whatever. Amud Rabbi Yochanan, lo shonu ela mois bezoil peiros biyoter. This only applies though if money is cheap and pay, in other words, easily available, but produce is expensive. So in other words, people are able to earn money, but prices are high because of shortages or whatever. That's when we're saying that unless prices are abnormally high or there's nothing to buy or whatever, you're not supposed to leave Eretz Yisrael. But if money is hard to get, you know, there's no job, or during the depression or whatever, you know, prices may be low, but nobody's earning any money.
Right, prices were low.
Yes. Afilo umder in the seller, even if prices are the normal thing for such a seller, so prices are cheap, but you don't have any money to buy anything at that price. Yotzin, you're still allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael under those conditions. And again, we have a simon, sella, poyo, charuva, talya, amrin. These are going to be five statements that Rabbi Yochanan said, that Rabbi Yochanan said. So statement number one, the Amr Rabbi Yochanan, why we see that Rabbi Yochanan himself also said, Nehuna kad habu kaiman arba sin b'sela. I remember when prices were, you could get 4 sah of wheat for a sela, which is a normal going rate. And yet, habu nefishi, nefichei kafan b'tveria midalet iser. And yet, there were many people who were swollen with hunger in Tveria, which is where we lived, because they didn't even have an iser. They had no money. So even though prices were cheap, it didn't do any good if they didn't have any money to buy anything. There was a depression. So therefore, we see from that if there's a depression, then that's a legitimate reason to leave.
But when there's an inflation, no.
Well, yeah, that's what we're saying. But Amr Rabbi Yochanan, so another thing Rabbi Yochanan says, Nehuna, I remember, Kadloi Havam Bitagrin, Poyalaya Lamadnach Karta. I remember when you couldn't get workers to hire themselves out to work on the east side of the city. Mereach Pita Maisin, because the smell of the bread would, the smell of the bread would kill them. Meaning, we learned earlier in the Masechta when we talked about the wind in the second parak, we talked about the wind from the west is very strong. It carries smells very easily. The bread in Tveria was so good that it would bring the smell of it to the east side of the city, and the smell was so overpowering that it would kill people.
It would kill people.
It was such an overpoweringly good smell that the neshamas would fly away from their bodies. Or the Rashbam says another explanation. No, that's the second explanation of the Rashbam. His first explanation is just the smell itself was so good that it made them expire. The second explanation is, yeah, that it's a continuation of the previous one. Because people were starving, they'd smell the smell of the good bread, and yeah, then that's it.
That's an interesting first explanation.
Yeah.
I mean, that must have been some good bread.
I guess so. Okay. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, another thing Rabbi Yochanan says, Nehuna kan have a bota yinuka charuva. I remember when a child would break open a carob, and usually carobs are fairly dry, but have a nugget chuta de dub shal train drahi, and a string, a thread of honey would come out, and it would flow out of it and flow all over his two arms. In other words, even the carobs were juicy when he was younger, he says. But Amr Rav Elazar, similarly Rav Elazar says, Nehirna kad have a notal urva bistra. I remember when it could happen that a raven would grab a hold of a piece of meat and then fly away with it. The nugget chuta de mishcha mirei shura v'adla ara, and there'd be a line of fat that dripped from the meat that would go from the top of the wall down to the ground. Both of them, it's basically the same idea, that there was a time when the fruit in Eretz Yisrael and the meat in Eretz Yisrael was much richer than it is in later
times. It was called commercial farming.
No, before the bracha went away. Before the bracha went away. There's other gemaras. There was a gemara. We had a gemara in Bava Metzia also that mentioned that in Rabbi Yochanan's time, the land of Eretz Yisrael was much more productive, and by Rabbi Elazar's time, it was much less. Yeah.
Twice as productive.
Yeah.
The food quality in Eretz Yisrael is excellent.
It's still better now, but still it was much better even in those times. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, Nehuna kadav m'taylin talya v'talyos v'shuka. I remember when boys and girls would play in the street, k'bar shif etzrei v'k'bar shev etzrei, they could be even 16 and 17 years old, v'loy habu chotan, and they wouldn't come to any averus because they had a sense of tzniut. And actually, before Shem said, it's connected with the two previous things. When they had a spirit of tara, then there was a fatness in the fruit and the meat. Once that went away, then so did that. Of Amr Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan says another thing. Nehirna, I remember, Kadavu Amin Be'medrasha, when they used to say in the Bismedrash as follows. The Moidi Lahoin, anybody who. Kadavu Amin, when they used to say, Be'medrasha in the Bismedrash. The Moidi Lahoin Nofel B'yedehain, anybody who admits to them, to the Goyim, meaning that he accepts what they say, Nofel B'yedehain, he will end up falling into their hands. So therefore, if they're saying something, you're obligated to go and point out their fallacies and point out that they're good when they're coming with apicursis or whatever it is. Yeah. The mistrechei talayha, and somebody who trusts in them, Somebody who trusts in them, delaying what was originally his is going to wind up being theirs. And the Rashbam gives an example from the story of Chizkiyahu, the messengers from the king of Babel came to him, and he showed them all his treasures and everything we'll learn about in Sanhedrin, Beth Hashem, and then Yeshaya comes to him with a nevuah that because of that, all these treasures are eventually going to be taken captive by the kings of Babel, this very same nation that you trusted, that you thought are your reliable allies.
So yeah. No listening to what they're...
So no listening to what they're saying or without
it. No, we have to.
No, there's two different things. Modulahan, you can't. Yeah, you have to counter argue. Well, yeah.
Yeah, the weather forecasts are incorrect.
No.
You have to. Practically nowadays, you have to know how to answer people.
That is also true.
The more you get into an argument, otherwise you walk away, and that's what.
That is all true. Okay, we got to go to Meyer's now. If anybody wants. We didn't get. I would have liked. We did get to the two dots. I would have liked to finish the Perek though. So if anybody wants, if anybody's able to after Meiriv, maybe we'll continue a little bit. If you have to go, then fine.
Bedtime.
All right.
Oh yeah.
All right.
Zalman has bedtime.